I think I'd be more going back to strictly amateur now, because money does corrupt an awful lot of the sports, and I think there is something precious about the whole idea of somebody going out and doing their best for nothing, for the sake of themselves and their family and their parish and their county. I think it's something that's a national treasure.
Hello again, and welcome to the Insights podcast with Sean O'Rourke. My guest in this episode is a Gaelic football manager, retired secondary school principal, sports broadcaster and columnist, not to mention a hugely decorated former player, having won two All-Ireland medals with Meath and Player of the Year in 1991. Colm O'Rourke, you're very welcome to the Insights podcast.
Thank you very much.
I have to say again, no relation though. If I got a fiver for everybody who calls me Colm by mistake, I'd be a wealthy man. So obviously one of us is admired, and it's not me throughout the country. But in any event, recently you managed the Meath County footballers to collect their first silverware in Croke Park in 13 years. That was the Tailteann Cup in 2023. You continue writing extensively on subjects ranging from football to education and politics, largely in the Sunday Independent. You're very welcome, Colm, as I say. But look, I want to go right back. Do you remember the first time you played Gaelic football? Because I kind of got into you.
Well, I suppose the first time I would have played was probably in primary school. I grew up with seven older brothers and four sisters, so football was very much part of the family background. And when you grow up in rural Ireland, and I started playing with screens, so it was the natural progression. The older brothers were all playing.
But your family didn't start in County Meath, is that right?
No, we came from Leitrim in 1966. So my older brothers actually played with Leitrim. My oldest brother, Fergus, who has passed on, he played for years with the Leitrim senior team. So there was a bit of a divide in the house, actually. The older members of the family would have identified as sort of Leitrim, and the younger members would have been very much Meath.
But they wouldn't have met each other because of the provincial. Leitrim would have been getting too far anyway. They wouldn't have met in All-Ireland.
Seamus O'Rourke, another O'Rourke, makes reference to it on occasions about the people who left Leitrim, who could have played with Leitrim.
You are a two-time All-Ireland winning player, as I say. You reckon you should have perhaps had a third one. That one escaped. But you're Footballer of the Year in 1991. So when you look back, I mean, you must have huge positive memories of your time in football.
Yeah, but I think most footballers look back and they often think more of the games that got away than the ones they won. And I think that's a sort of a common theme with a lot of players. I remember more some of the games where I did stupid things and made mistakes and we lost. And I suppose the 91 final against Down, after playing the four games against Dublin, that would have been one that sort of got away. But like overall, everything was good. Like played in a lot of big games. A lot of Leinster, I think I was played in 10 Leinster finals and we won five of them, you know. So, and in the end of career, I suppose something that gave me nearly a lot of satisfaction, or most satisfaction, was win a couple of club championships with Screen, because the first five senior championship finals I played with them, we lost them all. And I was 35 or 6 before we won a championship. So that was a great achievement for me on a personal level and for the club.
And of course, you went on to manage your son's team, another club, to similar success at county level.
Yeah, and that maybe even give more satisfaction, because Simonstown had never won a senior championship. I was living in Navan, and the sort of northern side of Navan, which of course is always the poor side in every town. We were the poor club to O'Mahony's, and Shane started playing with them, and of course I got involved at underage. So in 2016 and 2017, we won two senior championships. So that was very satisfying.
As it happens, not every good player makes a good manager. So what was it that worked for you as a manager?
Well, I don't know whether I was a good manager or not, but I suppose when you're there and willing to do the job, you often get it. So I was involved with Simonstown all the time. But of course, I was involved very much in St. Pat's, even from the time I was playing club and playing with Meath. I was also managing the teams in school. So I got great experience with that. And we had a sort of a 20-year period where we had a great innings with St. Pat's as well, and won three All-Ireland Colleges Championships and I think 9 or 10 Leinsters in that time. So it was a good sort of grounding for education and management.
That background, though, I mean, as you say, if you're willing to do the job, you don't always get it. I mean, I think it was a third or fourth time of trying you became manager of the Meath senior county team.
Well, I probably got it when I didn't want it. The first couple of times I would have taken it, and the last time it was a sort of, I was asked to do it. I didn't apply for the job or anything like that. So got the job then, and it didn't work out as well as I would have liked. And I probably would like to have stayed another year. I wanted a succession plan with bringing in people from underage teams. So it didn't work out. So
what about, tell me a little more, Colm, though, about the times you applied for the job and didn't get it.
Well, it's just at that time, like my ideas didn't fit at the time. I had put in a lot of proposals along with managing the team, that it was a sort of a bigger package than just a purely senior team job. It was encompassing nearly all aspects of Meath football. So maybe it was looked on as pretty radical for the time.
Did they ever give you a reason specifically as to why not you?
Well, I suppose maybe they thought they had somebody better. So, you know, fair enough. You know, in life, you look for some things, you just don't get them. You have to move on.
Yeah, but you got off to a promising start, as they say, winning the Tarleton Cup. OK, it's not quite Sam Maguire, but it was a start. But it only lasted for 2 years. So where did it come apart?
Well, it didn't come apart insofar as I thought we were still making progress, because myself and the rest of the management team had sort of decided is that we were going to go with a bunch of players who were 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, and that it was going to take 3 to 5 years before they were going to be good enough maybe to challenge for provincial or All-Ireland honours. And we won the Tailteann Cup. We started back in the league, and I think 7 of those players were unavailable through injury, so we got knocked back and nearly had to build a second team overnight. So it was going to take time. My ideas and the county board's ideas of how we should progress were a little bit different. So basically I told them I just wasn't happy with the way things were developing. Yeah, and I'm too old for the hassle.
It's not too long since, and people remember, OK, it is 30 years since that four-game epic with the Dubs in the Leinster Championship. But, I mean, Meath were a power in the land. They were every bit as good as the Dubs, you know, in your time.
Yes.
and later indeed as well, and winning All-Irelands. So how do you explain the decline? OK, Dublin has huge population. They got better, clearly, than everybody else. And their success in recent times, you know, is testament to that. But, like, Meath should have been holding their own with, you know, the Kerrys, the Corks. They fell away very, very badly.
Yeah, and I don't have a sort of rational explanation for it, because, like, St Pat's, take an example, were in 14 Leinster finals in 20 years up until 2013, and we're still putting in the same resources, money, management, expertise, everything, or even more, and we haven't got to a Leinster final in the last 12 years. So it's very hard to explain, and the two things seem to go together. The school going well, the county team was going well. Like, Meath should be better. I think they will be better. I think things are getting better. But there was a period there maybe where administration was poor and things weren't looked after. You know, I'd say the eye was taken off the ball, because we had about 20 years where under Sean Boylan, I think Meath, he won 4 All-Irelands and had Meath in 8 All-Ireland finals in a short period of time. And I suppose people often think this will last forever, and nothing lasts forever, I suppose.
Yeah, and one of the points I think you made, you know, in recent times is that, you know, counties that were hungry for success, and eventually it came to them last year in both hurling and football, the teams were managed by people who were given time. In the case of Clare Hurlers, Brian Lohan, was it 5 years? And much longer than that in the case of Kieran McGeaney. Lucky though they were in the end. I would say that, wouldn't I?
You would say that, and it probably is true. But, like, in fairness to McGeaney, he stuck it out, and I'm quite sure that he had it's fairly obvious he had a lot of critics from within his own camp during that time, but he did produce the goods in the end, and they got progressively better. It was a sort of inch by inch by inch. Like, they went, I think, 5 years or 6 years under him without winning an Ulster Championship match. So I thought we were going to have to do the same progression, going to have to be very, very patient. I didn't see it coming, ultimate success coming in my time anyway, even if I spent 3 or 4 years at it. But I would add hope to put a base in place for the next man.
We'll talk a little more later, Colm, about the GAA, the new rules and the shape of the association. But moving now, you referred a few times to St Patrick's Academy, I think it's called.
Classical school.
Classical school. 900+ students in Navan. You were principal there for, was it 14 years out of 42?
Yes.
That was quite the shift, as they say. did you enjoy being principal? It's a lot of responsibility in very changing times.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. I thought it was the greatest job in the world. And I went into school every day and everybody was nice to me. And the boys were friendly and respectful and courteous almost all the time.
You're not saying that now with your tongue in your cheek?
No. I found that every day. I just found young people brilliant to work with. And I suppose the circumstances were different. I could have stayed for the rest of my life there. I enjoyed St. Pat so much.
And you had some able dealers there to deal with. I don't know, were you in their classroom? I'm thinking of people like Hector and Tommy Tiernan.
I taught the two of them, actually. Yeah.
So that probably prepared you for anything, whether it was in a dressing room or in a principal's office or
yeah,
a staff
absolutely.
Room.
Yeah, absolutely. But like, you saw every side of life.
Were you strict?
Not really, no.
So
not
how did
really.
You get people to do what they needed to do?
Well, I had a good management structure and some of them were stricter than me, so I could take an easier approach. But I found that, you know, the carrot worked much better than the stick.
And the school environment and the mix and society has changed so vastly since you began over 40 years ago. You recently wrote that your experience as a school principal is that even the most tuned in parents haven't a clue what's going on in the parallel universe that many young people live in. And you're referring there, I suppose, to social media. You say, yes. The shock and horror from parents over some online disclosures in my office would have been funny if the situation hadn't been so serious. What are you talking about there?
One of the biggest issues is the social media element of it and the unvarnished world of what a lot of these people live in, whether it's pornography, I'd say, is a very big issue online with a lot of young people and relationships and like even explicit photographs being shared among them of each other as well. Oftentimes that was shock and horror for parents and even those who were tech savvy parents. In general, the young people are miles in front of them in terms of what is going on.
I think you took a fairly strict approach, for instance, to the possession of mobile phones or smartphones in classrooms. I mean, how did you manage that? And maybe as a kind of a subsection of that question, what do you make of the proposed regime now where they're going to have these pouches where the phones will be stored for the school day?
I really didn't think that was a runner at all. The policy we had was very simple. You know, you were supposed to put your phone in your locker at the start of the day and you could take it out at the end of the day. And if you were caught with the phone, you lost it for a week. And it worked very well. Now, the reality is that everybody didn't put their phone in their locker every day and some of them had them in their bag or in their pocket. But if they were caught with them, and the worst offence in the world for any young fella was to lose his phone. And I used to have the funniest dealings with fellas when they come in and somebody had taken their phone off them for a week. And the first thing that I always say is, I need my phone. And I said, well, we're going to have an exercise in the English language here now. The difference is you want your phone. There's a big difference. You don't need it. And I need my phone. How will I know when to get training and things like that? And I'd say, well, you know, I used to go training as well and I didn't have any great problem. I didn't need a phone. And I said, I'll ring for you. Whoever is in charge of your team, tell them to ring me into school and I'll get the message to you.
But so, what about parents there? I mean, they might be saying, you know, look, the child does need, I need to stay in touch. I need to know where they are at the weekend. How did you deal with that? Or were parents maybe sometimes more difficult to deal with than the students?
The parents would be much more difficult. Like if you have almost 1,000 students, you have 2,000 parents. And they would often be like largely very compliant and very supportive. But you would get very awkward people, particularly with phones and that sort of thing. But we had a fairly strict rule on it. And other schools, it may not have just worked as well in other places. I'm not saying that we had a sort of a perfect relationship, but 95% of parents were very supportive. And oftentimes, if they heard that the son had the phone taken off them, they'd say, well, no harm at all. He'd be better off with it.
Was this a boy, all boys?
All boys, yes.
Yeah. What's your view, by the way, of co-ed? I mean, do you think it would be better? Do you see education moving in that direction?
I do. I think it's a more natural form of education. Oftentimes I would say that, like, it's a strange thing that, you know, they're being educated together at a primary level and then the divergence take place. I know there's an argument for that girls do better in single-sex schools. I don't know whether that is right or wrong. I think people will do well in any school if they are committed to school.
Now, one of the points you've made in your columns, and you've been writing extensively about this over the years in education column, is that AI, artificial intelligence, presents a particular danger or a threat or challenge to the brighter students who play it by the book, as opposed to maybe the dossers who are good, you know, on the keyboard or on the iPhone. AI can make up the difference where they haven't done the work.
It was in light of the new proposals where there's a lot of changes to this subject at senior cycle level. And like, obviously, I've gone now from the direct-to-day involvement in this, but with 40% of the total marks being available for project work that's done under the supervision of the teacher. Now, it's something that I would have said for years and years and years and campaigned for, and it's something like in Irish, for example, I would say like that I'd forget about oral or oral Irish and written and grammar and stuff like this, particularly for the weaker students, and make 90% of the subject oral to get people just to be able to converse some amount, because I always found a dreadful thing with people saying I hate Irish and they want to get out of Irish, and they often go then to the educational psychologist and get a diagnosis that they're not able to do Irish, and then they do Spanish instead. You know, this sort of stuff is going on. So, like, we need to make Irish a much, much user-friendly subject. I think it's been far too much on grammar and prose and poetry and stuff like that. I'd love to see everybody being able to speak. But on the wider scale, then 40% of a lot of other subjects now are going to go with a sort of project work. I can see that as a major difficulty now with AI, because all they have to do is go to some of the chat and whatever sites, put in the basic information, and they get their work.
So what's the way around that? Because AI is not going away.
No, it's not going away, and it's going to be a massive advantage in a whole load of areas. Like, you know, but like, there's a wider thing here, I think. Is knowledge valuable in itself, or is it just access to knowledge is the future? And I'd always say knowledge has to be valuable in itself. So I think that for the integrity of exams, we're going to have to move back, I think, towards a system where you have individual examination. Like, somebody sits down and they're examined on some part of work that they're doing. It's going to be cumbersome, expensive, but I think that AI have changed the rules and there's no putting the genie back in the bottle.
So that's in regard to, say, things like projects and so forth.
Yes.
But what about, say, the big, you know, be-all and end-all, as it was and has been and remains, the Leaving Cert, that largely written exam?
Yeah, well, I don't see anything wrong with a terminal exam with a percentage of it to do with it. I still think that there is value in that. That's something nobody can disrupt in any way. So long as, again, they keep the phones, that nobody can go near a toilet, nobody can have a phone that they can go out and look when they go on their toilet break and things like that.
How widespread are those abuses or that kind of cheating?
I'd say it's naive to believe that it doesn't take place on a fairly large scale. Mm. I think because every student has a right to go to the toilet, all they have to do is have their phone in their pocket going out or their phone in a bag outside. So.
And what about the damage, as you saw it, done by COVID to the Leaving Cert? You were particularly aggrieved or critical of the way the marks were amplified to make up for the, if you like, the challenges presented by COVID.
Well, I could see no good reason for that, because, like, you know, if you, instead of having 500 points one year and you have 600 the next, all it means is that the entry requirement to particular things at third level go up in line with it. So I could see no good reason why the Leaving Cert results were exaggerated on those years. Like, it should have been just the same. But there was also, of course, a bias in favour of some of the schools from certain areas. So,
what do you mean by that now? Do you mean DESH schools?
Yes.
Or do you mean, yeah.
So, like, I think the better students were discriminated against at that time. And I'd say there was a lot of people who maybe should have been able to get first choice courses who didn't get them.
And what about the general thrust that's there for a long time towards, you know, pushing or encouraging students to go towards third level education as opposed to maybe going for apprenticeships? Do you have a view on that?
Oh, very much so. I think that the German system, where a much smaller percentage will go directly to college, is the sort of one that we should be following. I think that the whole system has to change. At times we had 80% of our students going, and people complimenting me on this, going to third level. I used to actually think that was a very bad thing. I did thought that maybe 50% should be going. And I tried to encourage as many as possible go towards apprenticeship. But I do recall one big employer who was a plumber in the area asking me, could he come into the school about getting apprenticeships? And I said, no problem, I'll get all my leaving certs together. You can talk to them and try and get. So there was about 170 doing the leaving cert at that time. And he couldn't get one person to go as an apprentice plumber. And he was going to give them the full works, make sure they got to college and everything else. And I just thought, that's a reflection of a sort of bias towards college now that's taking place. And in some ways, turning people, their noses up at what I would think are the real things people should be going for at the moment, where there's guaranteed employment and a great future, possibility of self-employment. But people think that college is, it's a
That's
sort
extraordinary
of a,
though.
It's a snobbish type of attitude towards education.
I mean, not one person signed up for an apprenticeship, but I mean, how many of your 170 actually went to the talk with them?
The vast majority. The vast majority. So, like, you know, people had their mind made up, like, I'm going to college. It's changing again now. It is beginning to change, and people are beginning to realise, you know, that they don't have to go to college. And the other big problem, of course, is the access to college by the huge numbers means that there's huge failure rates then and huge dropout rates for first years and second years in college. That part of it, the statistics on that, I'm not exactly sure on, but that's a big issue, like people getting into courses then that they're not fit for or they have no interest in.
As somebody who comments and writes and analyses on education and social matters, as we've been discussing, I suppose politics was something that, you know, wouldn't be far from your own thoughts, maybe activities. I mean, do you come from a political background, or have you lined up with any particular side?
Well, my uncle was a senator for Fianna Fáil for many years, and my father, I suppose, was a big Fianna Fáil supporter. But like everything else in life, the sort of boundaries for politics tended to break down over time. So, you know, for example, Shane McEntee was a very good friend of mine when he was, and of course, Helen now is Minister for Education.
His daughter, Shane, was the Fine Gael junior minister who died very tragically.
Yeah, so I would support good people.
Was your
Fianna Fáil background, but I would have no problem supporting other candidates who I
and
know.
Of course they're together now in coalition government.
Yes.
And as you say, you know, she's a Meath woman. She's the Minister for Education. No doubt you might be inclined to offer her some advice, or are you? Or she might be inclined to look to you for some advice.
Maybe the advice I'd be giving her would be certainly different from the advice she'd be getting from her department officials anyway. So I found frustrations as principals with a lot of the stuff that went on at department level. So
what kind of things?
One of my great hobby horses was the leaving certs results would come out on a Wednesday or Thursday. A person would get their result in traditional form from the State Exams Commission. They'd be busy trying to tot up their points with their hands shaking as they wrote down this, trying to figure out how much. I could never figure out why the results couldn't come out, the total points that they got. And along with that, on the same form or whatever way it was communicated to them through email, would be their first choice place in college. Because you had a stupid situation. A person would get the results 1 week and they'd have to wait for the following week to, did my 450 points get me into the college course I want, or did my 600 points? Because the amount of points they got didn't matter. Did they get a choice, first choice in college with the number of points? So they had to go through the whole weekend worrying and waiting. Will this be enough? Will it not be enough? Like, surely two arms of the state education mechanism should have been able to come together and say, you got 520 points and you got your place in engineering in UCD.
So in other words, the numbers should have been crunched simultaneously by the CAO.
Yes.
As they were produced by the
state exam
system.
Commission. Like, something as simple as that.
Yeah, I mean, going back to what you were saying, I mean, I'm quite struck by that story about the plumber not getting one. Now, I mean, does that point to a serious gap in career guidance?
No, I'd say the career guidance people are doing their best. I'd say that we have been overtaken by, I suppose, events insofar as education, which of course is fantastic for us all. But like, people have to see education through the root of apprenticeship as education as well. A lot of people looked on apprenticeships. They looked on it that it was nearly a step down, whereas it should be looked on as part of third level education in itself and has a value in itself. So I think more emphasis needs to come from all the different institutions of state to try and guide people more in that regard, and that it's seen as the value in itself.
How would you deal with, or how did you deal with an underperforming teacher?
Well, I always had my issues with the ASDI, and we carried on a sort of a battle for about 40 years, but in a good-natured sort of way. But because I felt that, you know, union should be looking at the bigger picture. Okay, they represent our members, but like you can't represent your members to the detriment of students. So, like, it's a bigger picture altogether. But the underperforming teacher is a difficult one, and there is a mechanism that you can go through, but it's a long, protracted type of thing, and oftentimes is quite unsatisfactory in terms of resolution of a particular case. Like, in every job in life, there's a percentage of workers who underperform. I would have to say that for the vast majority of my time as principal, that there was very few teachers underperforming, very, very few. And some of the ones who were underperforming had personal issues, and you have to try and deal with them in as empathetic a way as possible. In a lot of jobs, ultimately the axe comes down if somebody is underperforming. In teaching, it doesn't really happen like that. But, you know, you sympathetically try to get people maybe to move on and to go to do something else.
And were you successful at that? Maybe not always, but not always. Occasionally?
Not always. And, you know, there's sad cases with people. Like, you know, you're dealing with people who may be coming through traumatic times themselves, and you have to understand that and deal with them as best you can.
Coming back to football, Colm, the GA is, I suppose, it's in a constant state of flux, and it's, you know, no doubt the great national organisation, not without its faults. I'm sure you would accept it. In fact, you've written about a lot of them a lot of times. But how do you see it now? I mean, particularly I'm thinking of the commitment that's required. It's, to all intents and purposes, you know, it's professional, the demands that are made on players, particularly at inter-county level. You floated the idea previously of it maybe being semi-professional, but that would have serious implications down the road for the future of county teams, for instance.
Yeah, well, I think maybe that was quite a while ago.
Only about 5 years.
I think I'd be more going back to strictly amateur now, because money does corrupt an awful lot of the sports. And I think there is something precious about the whole idea of somebody going out and doing their best for nothing, for the sake of themselves and their family and their parish and their county. I think it's something that's a national treasure. So how do you balance that then with the time commitments? That is a big issue. Like, you know, we did put a lot of demands. Even when I was manager, I said, you know, we're not going to train as much and we're not going to do that. But you tend to find yourself, you get on the treadmill and it's very hard to get off it. So like a lot of the players now are nearly professional except without pay. And it's a lifestyle. And it's not a healthy lifestyle in a lot of ways too, because they don't have as much fun as when we were playing. That's the one big difference that I would have seen. You know, you don't have the laughs, you don't have the nights out, because they don't drink very much. You know, they have a Spartan existence. They're watching their food, they're watching their exercise, they're watching everything. And they're to be admired for it. But ultimately, it's supposed to be about enjoyment. And I wouldn't be sure that they would have the same level of enjoyment as we had.
The new rules.
Yeah, I'd be a broad supporter of them, because anything that brings a bit of... Like, the game had gone to a turgid, boring type. It was turning off people. Most older people in particular, I think, would have found Gaelic football very unenjoyable. And I think they were voting with their feet. Like, the figures showed, like the returns recently from Croke Park were showing that attendances had gone down. So it was time for a radical revamp. And overall, I would be... To be some of them, I wouldn't be gone on, but overall, I'd say.
But you were suggesting in a recent piece, Colm, that we're likely to see as much, if not more, hand passing as there's been prior to these enhancements, to use the Jim Gavin phrase.
Well, the ball is going to be in play more often, so you're going to get more kicking, but you're going to get more hand passing as well. Now, I would have liked to have seen it, some measure to reduce hand passing, but they didn't bring it in. So The terms of reference was to make it a more exciting game. They have done that. But like the terms of reference didn't at any time when they were sitting down with his group to say, can you reduce the amount of hand passing? So a byproduct of more action is more kicking. But also, I think it's going to be more hand passing.
But I mean, if you were to reduce the amount of hand passing, you'd have to make it very easy to count. In other words, like, you know, you couldn't say 10.
No.
10 hand passes. I mean, it'd have to be maybe 3 or 4 max. A bit like the steps. And we know how respected that particular rule is, don't we?
Yeah, well, I suppose the referees would be able to go to 2 anyway. I think it would be fairly clear. But I think it would have been worth trying something fairly radical like that. It was tried before, and at the time I didn't like it, but that was a time when the ratio of hand passing to foot passing might have been 2-1. Now it's about 5-1, maybe more.
One of the positive things, I suppose, is, according to your most recent count, is there are 8 counties with a reasonable prospect of, you know, getting to and perhaps even winning the All-Ireland. That's all the teams, I think, in Division 1, which is a bit of an improvement on maybe relatively recent times.
Yeah, well, Dublin aren't the first to wear, but like, we're not going to, I don't think, see a team like Dublin again, because they had sort of generational players, maybe 7 or 8 of them, all came along nearly at the one time. So with Brian Fenton going and James McCarthy going, like two of the greatest players I have ever seen, and of course Paul Mannion and Jack McCaffrey and a whole host of other fellas handing in their guns, the whole scenario has now opened up. And I said the first division teams, like, one of the problems we had in the second division for the last couple of years, well, first year we had Dublin, who were All-Ireland champions, and Derry in our division, who were All-Ireland semi-finals. And then last year we had Armagh and Donegal, All-Ireland finalists and semi-finalists. So it meant for a competitive second division. I don't think you're going to have an All-Ireland winner from the second division this year. So you're going to have more competition between about 8 teams. The biggest problem of all is the bottom 10. Like, the Tailteann Cup now is no good to the fourth division teams. They have no chance of winning it, because it's going to be dominated by the teams who get relegated from the second division or the third division teams. So the competition structure needs to be rebalanced. There needs to be a third tier to cater for those who have no chance, and they should be given a chance. I think following on from the rules big change, and Jarlath Burns has to be commended for that, I think he needs a competition structure review. The provincial championships now are a waste of time, really.
But they love them, I mean, in Ulster particularly.
Well, Ulster says no to any change there. I tried to float that idea with Jarlath Burns, get rid of all the championships. So he, of course, there's no way that an Ulster president would put, but I was saying, you put the provincial championship first, get them out of the way, because they don't have much relevance anymore. Like, if you ask somebody who won the 4 provincial championships last year, you probably would have difficulty getting to know them, or you'd have difficulty getting who won the Division 1 title in the league last year. So it's really all focused on the All-Ireland championship.
Racing is another interest. It's more than an interest with you, isn't it?
Oh yeah, it's been an interest. Again, there's a huge tie-up between football and racing in County Meath in general. Like, you know, some of the top trainers like Gavin Crummell and Noel Meade and Gordon Elliott, for example, you know, they'd be great GA men as well. And a lot of the GA public are interested, particularly in national hunt racing. But I suppose my association, I've always been associated with those trainers, but also probably primarily with Jim Bulger on the flat. We've been friends for a long time.
And how did that come about, that friendship?
Well, we met actually at a function. He's a great hurling supporter, more so than football, but again, supports the GAA in general, and a Wexford man, and he would trace his huge interest back to the Rackards and the great team of Wexford of the 50s. So we met at some function and we got chatting about football, and it developed from there. So I've been fortunate to be with him in some of the great race courses of Ireland and England.
And did you ever get to own a leg of a horse yourself?
Ah, yes, we've had good horses together, and we still have horses together. We have interest in a few horses still. So it's something that I've been involved with him for 30 years, and I've been at some of the great successes he had in Ascot and Newmarket. And
he's a very serious man, isn't he?
Not really.
No?
He comes across like that. I suppose he's self-made, and he's had to built an empire from scratch.
On the National Hunt side, Colm, I suppose there's a sense among some people, call them begrudgers and not without reason, that people like Willie Mullins, they're akin to the Dubs in football. They've grabbed so much success and to the detriment of others, the small-time operator.
Yeah, it must be very difficult. But I suppose Aidan O'Brien on the flat, Willie Mullins over jumps. But again, nothing lasts forever there as well. There's been domination by different groups. But like you have, Gavin Crummell has improved significantly. And of course, Gordon Elliott and Noel Mead has become a sort of a flat on National Hunt operation. So you have a lot of people like Ger Lyons and other Mead trainers. So you have a lot of people. But the National Hunt is very much dominated by Willie Mullins. But only... can only admire the talent that he has.
Are you a Cheltenham goer yourself?
Absolutely. I love Cheltenham. But Cheltenham has become an expensive place. And it's, or I think they're pricing themselves a bit out of the market there. It's not what it used to be. It was, I think, exemplified best by, I think, was it 7,000 British fans came for the Dublin Racing Festival. A lot of the English people that I was talking to in Leopardstown over the couple of days felt a far better value for money by coming to race in
Ireland.
Coincided
with an important rugby match as well. I'm sure some of them got to that too.
Yeah, well, one of the problems in Ireland, I suppose, Sean, is that people who are interested in sport are often interested in everything, and the GA people would like to go to the rugby matches and go to the racing and whatever. Like, I was in Paris 2 years ago now for the World Cup for the game with the All Blacks, but there seemed to be more GA people at the match than anybody else. You could meet people from all over the place. But it's a great credit to Irish that we are not sort of pigeonholed on any one sport. We'll support soccer, rugby, football, racing, whatever is going.
And I think it's been observed by a lot of people, it's kind of a statement of the obvious, I suppose, that like the sporting organisations, primarily the GA, but the others as well, rugby, soccer, racing, they helped us through and keep us sane throughout the bad times of the crash. And, you know, there was that kind of outlet for people and by way of participation primarily. I mean, I think you got to belt yourself during the crash, did you, from a project you were involved in with others?
I did, yeah. Well, that's gone back to 2008, 2009, and thankfully got that out of the way and got it all sorted. Now, if you look at some of the websites, they still say this, but like all my financial affairs have been sorted out for 6 or 7 or 8 years at this stage. But a lot of that stuff that goes up online, first of all, I didn't try to get it down or get any of it changed, but it does appear to be difficult that once something appears about you that it stays in the public domain forever.
Well, I suppose the association being a public figure as you are, yes, albeit one who's an amateur involved in through your involvement in sport, but was it a particularly difficult time for you on a personal and family level?
Yeah, it was a very difficult time because I'd been involved in projects before that which were quite successful, so to get involved in another one which came at the wrong time. It was a difficult time because
From the point of view of people who mightn't be familiar, you were involved with others. I think was there about 7 or 8 of you in a project in Navan?
There was four, and the thing went wrong, as it did for the vast majority of people who had been involved in projects, and the crash came. So I had to deal with it. It was difficult for myself. It was difficult for my family. But again, that doesn't kill you, hardens you.
I suppose it is a fair point that a lot of people took blows. How did you find the bank to deal with, I mean, in the midst of that? I mean, it would have been great at handing over the money in the good time.
I think that people with profile, I think, were treated more severely, I think, at that time. I think the lesson, sort of, the idea was that these people had to be shown that they were going to be dealt severely with so that nobody else could think that they were going to get off easier. So it was a protracted thing. It went on for years. It was tough going, but it was probably more difficult on my wife, Patricia, than on me. I went into school every day and some young fella come into the office and he'd say, sorry, I forgot my lunch. Will you give me €2 so I can go to the canteen? Or I lost my bag and we'd go off and search for it. So you had all those sort of human contacts every day to keep you completely sane.
Right. I mean, I think the papers report you lost, was it about 850,000?
No, it was a good bit more than that. But we got it all sorted anyway and we had to make a settlement. And it's taken me until now to continue paying back what I've lost. But like, that's finance. Like, I was fit and healthy and well, So others suffered much worse than I did from the whole thing.
Have you been tempted to go back into it now to put your toe in the water again where a property is?
No. I think I've done my time. And I think I leave it at that.
As you look back on your career, and there's a fair bit of life ahead of you, hopefully anyway, I mean, you're in good fit shape and state. Is it the teaching that gives you more satisfaction, say, than the sporting side?
Yeah, I suppose it was. I always took more satisfaction from seeing others doing well than myself. So our students to do well, to get on well, to play with Mead, to be successful in their careers. And it was hugely successful groups, you know, and you see them after doing their leaving cert and seeing them getting what they want. And also, there was huge satisfaction for me in seeing people in the club doing well, particularly winning those championships, because I had had every one of those at either underage in the club or at school. So there was huge satisfaction in seeing them. In fact, my son and a couple of others had started with them, with me at 5 and 6 year olds. So they won the championship, I think, about 25 years later. So I always used to say it was an overnight success that took 25 years. Well, we lost two finals in the meantime as well. So, like, when you're a young club too and you're trying to make it to the top, because really, I suppose, every club to win a senior championship or to win an intermediate championship sort of copper fastens their status. So to get to the promised land was fantastic in that regard. Like a lot of the achievements of winning Leinsters or winning championships, I wouldn't run them down, but sometimes after the games and you win in All-Ireland, you'd say, well, was that it? Let's move on quickly. I always found them a bit of an anticlimax, to be honest.
Do you still meet up with your old fellow war horses from the glory days of Meath football?
I meet them regularly. Yeah, you know, sometimes you're told you should never meet your heroes. I got to play with them. So it was kind of, like, you know, those sort of fellas. I remember, like, we went to the All-Ireland semi-final. Joe Castles, Jerry McIntyre and myself. Funny story. I drove the two of them to the All-Ireland semi-final. We beat Derry and we went off for a quiet drink afterwards. And we sat down and we were thinking of how long we'd been playing with Meath. And we totaled it up. And between the three of us at that time, we had been playing for 40 years with Meath. And we were getting to our first All-Ireland final. And we were just saying, well, sure, maybe we do deserve a crack at it after all this length of time. And it was in that regard I wrote about Paddy Cullen. I admired Paddy Cullen and the older Dubs because they played throughout the 60s when they were a joke. And they kept at it and kept at it up until 1974 when they won the All-Ireland. And of course, again, you don't want to be reminded of that.
Nor does Liam Salmon.
No. A pure gentleman, Liam.
Absolutely. Look, it's an extraordinary life that you've had so far. Have you any remaining ambitions?
I don't know. It's only the last couple of months has been the first time I have taken stock and sat back and had a look at things. I've been very busy with the football and various other things that I've been doing since I got out of St. Pat's 2 years ago. So I'd like to do something else.
What about another county?
No, absolutely. No, I wouldn't have any interest in any other county or any other club. Like, I've played with one club and I've managed another, and they're the only two clubs that I'm interested in as well. So I'm not one of these people on the circuit, even though I admire a lot of people have gone to other counties and have done a lot of good, and a lot of people have gone to clubs and brought them together and won championships. But no, I'm sort of like the savage that I just prefer my native shore.
Not a very long shore in County Meath, but there's a bit of it, I suppose. And you were out running in dunes in the days of Sean Boylan. Now, we know that there's a president in the White House who's a mere 78 years of age. You're a long short of that. Would you rule out, I know you've had approaches in the past to stand for election. Would you rule it out?
At this stage, it's too old. I want to, first of all, I went on holidays in January for the first time in my life. And I said to myself and my wife when we came back, we are going to be doing this every January for as long as we're able. So, like, you know, there is benefits in those sort of things. School was so structured and football was so structured. It's like you were trying to grab a week here and a grab week there and find time. So there is now time to do things. We have grandchildren, which I
It's a very wonderful experience,
enjoy,
isn't it?
Very much enjoy. I think that's one of the great blessings of life. So when they say, will you mind the grandchildren? I say, how soon do you want me?
What a lovely thought on which to end. Colm O'Rourke, it's been an absolute joy and pleasure to listen to your insights. Thank you indeed.
Thank you, Sean.
To hear more in this series, go to rte.ie/podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.